You're listening to I Am the Gentry, and I'm Kara Gabriel. Chapter 10, Midkid. When I was a freshman in high school, my math teacher once told my class that he was only a teacher because he wanted to be a teacher, not because he had to be a teacher. He explained that, in fact, he was so rich from real estate investments, he could, quote, buy all of our parents and put them on a shelf. But he enjoyed teaching, enjoyed math, enjoyed being around young people. And so we found ourselves together in third period math for not one or even 2 years. No, Larry Kowalski taught me math for all of the 3 high school years I was enrolled in it. His lady friend was my 9th grade honors English teacher, Miss Mulligan. Miss Mulligan was mouse-faced and tiptoed around the classroom, misquoting Julius Caesar and trying feebly to ignite some enthusiasm in her sleepy students. She is also the teacher who tried to convince me that epitome was pronounced with only 3 syllables, epitome. Together, they were charged with teaching the best and the brightest of East Greenbush, New York. Larry K. once told my mostly boy math class that I was, quote, a tank. That girl right there, you don't want to marry that. She's a tank, I'm telling you. And I should have been outraged. I should have reported him to the administration. But instead, beyond all comprehension, I found myself admiring him. Here, after all, was a man who knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted a stupid, meek woman like Miss Mulligan. He knew he could dominate and control her. He didn't want a woman like the one I hoped to become. Stubborn, unwieldy, difficult to control, and dangerous. Yes, a tank. And he intended to warn all of the high school boys about girls like me. But at the time, I didn't feel much like a tank. I laughed with my male peers day after day as my teacher made me the butt of his jokes. I was determined that they would not see me squirm. I played along because I knew intuitively that humor would save me. But even as I laughed, I felt myself shrinking. I tried to sink into my seat, to make myself smaller and smaller until maybe he wouldn't see me. I started wearing my father's jeans and sweaters to school, clothes that would drown me, that would hide my breasts and hips, that would help me blend in or disappear. But nothing seemed to work. Every day he was there, mocking everything from my work to my attire to the company I kept. I began secretly and subversively keeping a written log of all the moronic and offensive things Larry K. said. These quotes were so numerous that they obscured the last few pages of my notebook, and eventually the graphite scribblings smudged and bled onto the back cover. I read the quotes at night while I did my math homework, and they made me feel a little better. They became a symbol of all the petty, stupid, restrictive things I felt I would escape once I got to college. When I received the news that I was accepted to the small New England liberal arts college of my dreams, Larry K. told me I definitely shouldn't go there, that I would feel out of place, stupid, and poor. He informed me that everyone at Middlebury was rich and explained that my provincial background would not be received well. You'll be better off at Fredonia, he said, laughing. Save your parents' money. You'll fit in at Fredonia. I knew from the tomes of college research my mom had done for me that some people called Middlebury College Club Mid. I knew that the students there tended to be wealthy, smart, ambitious, and outdoorsy. I knew there was a laundry service wherein you could leave your bag of dirty laundry outside your dorm room in the morning and have it back, clean and folded, by later that night. And I knew that Ben and Jerry's ice cream was available at every dining hall meal, and on a few occasions that meal was lobster. Unlike Club Med, the origin of the nickname, Middlebury had no sugary sand or turquoise Caribbean water. The college had its own stark beauty, of course. Rolling hills and mountains that mimicked the waves of the ocean, sometimes a technicolor green, sometimes an autumnal rainbow. But for most of the year, those hills were blanketed in Arctic white. and the blue came not from the sea, but from the sky. Eye-stinging and crystal clear, so bright was the scene that the snow itself began to take on its bluish tint. And the sky and snow eventually blended into one another, just as the ocean blends into the horizon. No, there was no beach. But Middlebury had its own mountain, its own ski resort, its own inn, and a writer's colony. Everyone there seemed to come from the American aristocracy, a metaphysical destination we are told as children is achievable with hard work and determination, but is actually an identity that one is only born into. They were the true gentry, the privileged class, the blue bloods, legacy students whose parents and grandparents before them also attended Middlebury, the type of people who wear brand name underwear and who grew up with housekeepers to wash and fold that underwear for them, the type who traveled internationally from birth, whose bourgeois guilt and subsequent devotion to charity work was passed on from their parents, the type of people for whom acquiring a new Jeep Grand Cherokee for their high school graduation was as routine as watching the 6 o'clock news. To me, with the occasional exception, everyone there looked pretty much the same. We had been asked to submit a headshot with our college applications, and those headshots were then compiled, along with the name of each student's corresponding high school, into a catalog of freshman faces. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed, athletic young adults with rosy cheeks and wide smiles full of perfectly straight ivory teeth stared at me from every page. A friend of mine once lustily described a girl in our class as looking like she, quote, drank a lot of milk. As in, her skin kind of looked like milk, white, smooth, and creamy. Her hair was thick and full and straight and the color of straw at sunset. I spent hours staring at myself in the mirror, obsessing over skin that looked more like I guzzled olive oil than milk, and hair as dark as night. The old-fashioned hard copy college Facebook already factored heavily in the social lives of college freshmen, even before classes had properly begun. I studied my book before bed my first night in the dorms, memorizing names and faces of kids I might meet, looking for kind eyes, people I might befriend. The next day, about 200 students gathered on the quad to be divided into their outdoor orientation groups. It was a non-traditional, voluntary orientation in which incoming students were placed in groups of 6 or 8 and sent into the Vermont mountain wilderness to backpack and bond together for 3 to 5 days before classes began. Everyone spoke of this orientation opportunity as a life-changing experience in which college freshmen formed lifelong friendships. So I went in with the utmost optimism. And yet, rather than a victorious climb to the peak filled with dear new friends and fortifying experiences, my journey into the Green Mountains of Vermont seemed more like a descent into hell. It began as every group's trip began, with my group sitting in a small circle on the quad, our backpacks piled together in a giant heap. But before showing us how to pack our backpacks efficiently, our two group leaders casually passed a roll of toilet paper around the circle and said, "Take as much as you think you'll need for the next 3 days." I quietly panicked and proceeded to unravel about half the roll. My companions, whom I had known for all of 10 minutes, did not seem to think they would use the bathroom that much in the next 3 days because their little piles of paper dwarfed my own. When we had all stocked up on tissue, the group leaders giggled and said, "Just kidding! You can each take a roll, a whole roll! But now you each have to tell us one thing about yourself for every square of tissue you pulled off." Ugh, they howled at their cleverness, and I sat there, white tissue billowing like a cloud over my lap. The shared personal information that followed ranged from one kid telling us that he was clinically depressed and might not make it through college, to another kid telling us that her dad had bought her a Jeep Grand Cherokee for her high school graduation present. This revelation was met with a squeal from another student who said, "Wait, does your Jeep have pink upholstery on the inside?" Yes. Oh my God, my dad bought me the same Jeep for my high school graduation. Oh my God, no way. Yes, yes. Do you have yours here with you at school? Obviously, do you? Duh, of course. And a fast friendship was formed. Now, where I was from, kids just don't get brand new Jeep Grand Cherokees for high school graduation, or any other occasion for that matter. If a kid wanted or needed a car, they usually, one, received a hand-me-down from their parents, or two, fixed up an old beater they bought themselves after working a fast food job. And if they wanted or needed a truck, it was a real truck, not a luxury SUV. I once attended a party in the woods that featured a bonfire, case upon case of Natty Light, and a competition that involved giant pickup trucks pulling dumpsters with their respective tow straps. Each truck would hook up to the heaviest object they could find in the woods, primarily fallen trees, and tow the object as far and as fast as they could. The rest of the people at the party judged which truck was the meanest machine. Suddenly, one kid spotted a big, red, rusty dumpster. A full red, rusty dumpster. And before I knew it, the various pickup trucks were hooking up to the dumpster and dragging it through the clearing in the forest. The party only ended when one kid broke his tow strap and couldn't proceed with the contest. My family only had a small truck that could barely pull a U-Haul, let alone a dumpster, and we certainly never had a new Jeep Grand Cherokee. And for my high school graduation, I received a new dress and a small party with Sam's Club soda and La Bella pizza. My mom also took me shopping to make sure I was properly attired for my new life in Vermont. We went to the outlet stores where she bought me soft pink and blue flannel shirts and matching turtlenecks to wear beneath them. She bought me a massive teal winter jacket that enveloped me from neck to knee and puffed generously around my middle. My hat was a jaunty black wool bowler. I didn't know that most of my peers would be wearing fitted Patagonia ski jackets or vests from L.L. Bean. But the girls on my hall in my freshman dorm loved J. Crew the most. I had personally never owned a single item of clothing from J. Crew, and the most coveted brands from my youth were decidedly less preppy and outdoorsy than those at Middlebury. But there was no Z. Cavaricci catalog, and J. Crew offered a sporty yet stylish practicality that immediately appealed to me. I did not personally have a credit card at the age of 18, and my parents were not keen on allowing me to use theirs. So, my first mail order purchase in college was through a friend on my hall who was buying her fall wardrobe via the J. Crew catalog. I gave her cash for an enormous, bright, canary yellow, corduroy button-down shirt. And this friend down the hall ordered such a large batch of clothes on her credit card that she was able to sneak in my single chartreuse shirt without her parents noticing. I covertly referred to this girl who bought me my J. Crew shirt as Skipper because she was petite, youthful, sporty, and blonde. She was a totally benign, beige girl next door, one of dozens just like her at Middlebury, a peppy, preppy, plastic army of half-formed Stepford wives. And it wasn't just the students who bore a distinctively unified look. Every time my parents visited Middlebury, my mother, with her Wonder Woman blue-black hair and scarlet lips, would exclaim loudly in her nasal Long Island accent, "I don't look like the other mothers here. They all have straight hair and short bobs. God, Kara, they're all blonde. Or they just let it go gray. They don't dye it." And then, "They don't sound like me either. Where are they from? Does anyone here have an accent?" Or, "Why don't any of the other mothers wear makeup? They're like L.L. Bean or something. They're all very beige people. We're like red, and they're beige, you know?" At the time, I begged her to be quiet, to stop unintentionally spouting sentiments from the Nanny theme song, to not draw attention to our difference, to let it go and let me be, to bow out so that I could blend in, to help me make Larry K's oracle-like predictions less true. In the end, though, the part that really peeved me about Larry K's warning was that no costume change or careful erasure of my upstate New York working-class accent could mask the reality that I also didn't fit in intellectually or culturally. In high school, I had scoffed at the kids who had never been to New York City. My parents took me there several times a year, and though I had been persecuted for it, I prided myself on the fact that I was the cultural elite in my small town. But at Middlebury, I was surrounded by kids whose parents had second homes in New York. My parents took me to see the Secret Garden on Broadway, and I marveled at the lush green spectacle that magically transformed into a vibrant, multi-hued garden before my eyes. I came to college still humming about the bright golden haze on the meadow, lyrics from my final high school production of Oklahoma. But I learned when I got on campus that Middlebury didn't even do musicals because they were so proletarian. In high school, I barely had to audition to secure a role in a play. I took private voice lessons. I danced ballet with a professional company. At Middlebury, I couldn't get cast in anything, not even a student production. And the a cappella groups and the improv troupe rejected me too. I tried to find a ballet class, but quickly discovered that my pink tights and perfect turnout had no place in a curriculum that taught only modern dance. And then there was the academic work. For the first time in my life, I couldn't coast and get straight A's without studying at all. I had to complete every word of the reading just to get by. And even then, I had no idea how to participate in class discussions or write the type of papers that were expected of me. In my freshman seminar, entitled Passing, Silence, and Invisibility, we read, wrote, and talked about queer theory, feminist theory, race, and privilege. Prior to reading the book Passing by Nella Larsen, it had never even occurred to me that a Black woman could or would even want to pass for a white person. Up to that point, the only theory I had any experience with was in my piano lessons. I spent most of my freshman seminar just trying to figure out what the hell was going on, feeling angry at and jealous of the students who spoke like the theorists we read, students who seemed to intuitively understand the material, students who nodded enthusiastically every time my professor opened his mouth to speak. And through it all, I could see Larry K's pallid, ghostly face and the crooked, yellow, coffee-stained teeth grinning at me. Poor, stupid, and out of place. Had the worst of his predictions come true? My parents mortgaged their house a few times just to pay my tuition. I never flew to Vail for Christmas or booked a Caribbean cruise for spring break. But eventually, I took a course called Experiences of War, where I happened to learn something about tanks. And in addition to being savage and ugly and terrifying, they are powerful and resilient. They are faster than they look and more maneuverable, more adaptable than they seem. And although their aim is often imprecise, they can take hit after hit and continue crawling or climbing or changing course. And this, of course, is what Larry K was never clever enough to imagine. Although I had a difficult time becoming a part of Middlebury, Middlebury had to become a part of me. It was hard, really hard. And it was also totally worth it. It beat me down and bruised me badly. And just like a tank, I left that battleground a little muddier and a little dinged up. But I walked away smarter, more worldly, and ultimately a more agile critical thinker. I learned how to forge my own tracks over the terrain, how to create my own opportunities and not rely on others to present them to me. I developed a deep, lasting humility born of the knowledge that there will always be more I don't understand than I do. And for all of the heartache the college on the hill caused me, it also reminded me to embrace the difference in myself and others. It made me remember where I come from and reminded me of all my family had to sacrifice to get me there. in that isolated, homogeneous, frigid tundra, I somehow began to cultivate my mind and spirit. And every time I walked to class in a blinding blizzard, I leaned into the wind singing, "Come to my garden," or "There's a bright golden haze on the meadow." And what a sight it must have been. A puffy, teal, tank of a girl with fluttering chartreuse shirt tails, trudging to class and singing, her path imprecise, but fumbling and tumbling nonetheless over massive snow-covered hills. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the pod. You can also tell a friend, follow us on Facebook at I Am The Gentry, or follow us on Instagram and Twitter at gentry_pod. You can also support us by donating at patreon.com/I Am The Gentry, linked in the show description. See you next week.